from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Francis heads to Egypt as a messenger of peace and hope to a country where Christians are facing violence and an uncertain future. The Knights of Malta elect a new Grand Master who will guide the Venerable Order through reforms. And we have reached the 100-day milestone in the young administration of President Donald Trump. We talk to correspondents about all of these events here on Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, senior editor for the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio with Register Editor-in-Chief Jeanette DeMello. Jeanette is off this week. Coming up, EWTN News Nightly's Capitol Hill correspondent Jason Calvey will tell us about President Trump's first 100 days. But first up, Pope Francis is in Egypt this weekend on his most high-profile trip since visiting the Central African Republic in 2015. And it has assumed even greater importance since the tragic bombing of Coptic Christian churches on Palm Sunday that left dozens killed and more than 100 wounded. Francis will give a spiritual boost to the Christians in the country. He'll meet with leaders of Al-Azhar University, one of the leading centers for Islamic studies, and will encourage Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to do more to protect the Christian minority. To discuss all of this, we're joined by Edward Penton, Register Vatican correspondent. Well, Edward, welcome back to Register Radio.
Thanks. Good to be with you again, Matthew.
Well, by the time this episode airs, you're going to be on the ground in Egypt with the Holy Father. What exactly does Francis hope to accomplish with this visit?
Right. Well, he's going as a messenger of peace, and that's what he does always with his apostolic trips. But it's particularly important on this trip, of course, because of the violence there and the persecution of Christians in the Middle East, although it's not so profound in Egypt, although there is violence there. But he really wants to use this trip to build bridges with Islam, and particularly with the Al-Aqsa University, which is the prime learning center for Sunni Muslims in the world, which make up 80% of Muslims. So he really wants to use this as a launch pad, really, for his building bridges with Islam.
Yeah, well, you've touched on exactly the starting topic that I wanted to ask you about, and that is his meeting with the leaders of Al-Azhar. Now, I know that the Vatican has long-standing relationships with them, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, going back to the 1990s when that was started. But it broke off under Benedict XVI, who called on the Egyptian government to protect Christians after a bombing of Catholic churches, or Coptic churches, rather, in Egypt about 6 years ago. And so, but those have been restarted under France's relations with Al-Aqsa, and have actually become much better over the past 4 years. And so he's really keen to build on that, and obviously this visit will do much to do that.
And Cardinal Jean-Louis Touraine, who's the president of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, was recently there, wasn't he?
That's right. The members of the Vatican often have gone there to build up these relations with Al-Aqsa. So that's nothing new. But there is there's been this long-standing relationship. Critics will say, though, Matthew, that Al-Aqsa is stuck in the dark in the Middle Ages. Really, they say it hasn't moved on. This talk of dialogue that they say they want is actually not true. That they're just doing it for publicity reasons, and that really there isn't much advance there. It's really quite radically Sunni, and there isn't much room there for dialogue, they say, in Al-Aqsa. They're just sort of going through the motions. So that's what the critics say. But Pope Francis is obviously looking at it more optimistically and feels that there is room for building relationships with the university, which is considered actually to be the sort of Rome of the Muslim world, because it is so revered as this center of learning for Sunni Islam.
Well, what kinds of practical results might be possible from a successful meeting? Say everything goes exactly the way we all hope. What would be the result?
Well, this is the unknown answer, really, because I think over the years, it's often been the church which has made the move, and there hasn't been much of a sort of response from the Muslim side in terms of sort of practical improvement with the relations, you know, building up joint projects and stuff. But I think there is a possibility, I think, that there could be, you know, some joint project coming out of this, perhaps. I remember a few years ago there was, not with Al-Aqsa, but with an initiative called the Common Word Initiative, which really tried to build common ground with the Catholic Church on issues where there is common ground and where Islam could learn from the Church, and that's been quite successful. And that grew out, in fact, from the Regensburg, the controversial Regensburg Address of 2006. So there is that sort of precedent, but whether that will happen with Al-Azhar, we'll just have to see, I think.
Right. And did the heads of the university condemn the recent bombings?
Yes, they did, as far as I understand. But as I said earlier, they are very much, they do take the Quran and everything quite literally. And so whatever condemnation they give tends to be a little bit muted, because as Father Samir, Khalil Samir, this well-known Egyptian scholar of Islam, Jesuit, he will say that, you know, that there is this, that the sort of the true Islam, if you like, is one which sort of takes the Quran and the Summa literally. And so it's, they, you know, like Father Samir and others will say, well, the sort of fundamentalists are fulfilling what is a true Islam. Mm-hmm. And so Al-Azhar is always a bit tempered, I think, by what it says, because it knows that what it says will be interpreted by others as actually either being, if they become rather too soft on and condemn this sort of action, then the critics will say, well, you're not really fulfilling what is true Islam. So,
right.
so they sort of walk a fine line, really.
Well, and of course, Francis is going to be meeting also with Tewodros II, the head of the Coptic Christians. And my understanding is correct that he'll also be meeting with Patriarch Bartholomew?
Yes, he'll be there too. They'll both be taking part in this international peace conference, which is being held by Al-Aqsa on the first day that the Pope arrives. And so that's going to be an ecumenical meeting as well as an interreligious one. And of course, Patriarch Bartholomew is also very keen to build bridges with Islam as well. So there'll be a chance there for ecumenism as well as interreligious dialogue this trip.
Yeah, this trip, though, seems to be playing also into the wider concerns of the Church for peace in the Middle East, but also the unbelievable plight of Christians.
Yes, it does. And I, as far as I understand, the Vatican sees Egypt as being absolutely crucial in terms of bringing peace to the Middle East because of its very strong Muslim population, and something like 75% of Muslims in the country believe that Sharia law should be the law of the land, and even that non-Muslims should also follow Sharia law. 74%, mm-hmm. I believe, of Egyptians think that. So their belief is that if you can get to win the hearts and minds of the Egyptian Muslims, then there is a chance there to build peace in the wider Middle East. And I think that's the general perception of the Vatican with this trip, and I think it's why the Pope is very keen to go there.
Mm-hmm. And the Coptic Christians are the largest of the Christian minority groups across the Middle East, is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I believe it's 90% of Christians in Egypt are Copts, and that works out to about 9 to 10 million of the population of Egypt. So it's a very big population, and of course with a great history going back to 451 A.D.,
Well, exactly. And they have been a part of the cultural life of Egypt since the very beginning, haven't they? Since the arrival of the Church in Alexandria.
Yes, that's right. Sorry, before 451. 451 is when they actually broke away from the Catholic Church. They go back actually to the apostolic times. They one of the earliest churches. So they have quite a history there. I think they were the first church actually to start Christian monasticism, as well as having the first catechetical institute.
Right.
So they have a great history in the Church. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so Francis meeting also with the president of Egypt, President al-Sisi, part of it is to build better relations, obviously, but another is really to encourage protection of the Christian minority, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, that's part of it. And obviously, with the attacks on Palm Sunday, there's great concern for the Christians in Egypt. They aren't persecuted, but they are obviously sporadically targeted. And this is something which I think the Pope and Pope Tewodros, of course, is very keen to stop. And so al-Sisi, rather like President Mubarak, who preceded him before the Arab Spring, I think they're both seen as being capable of actually bringing about some order, unlike Mohamed Morsi, who was the Muslim Brotherhood president who preceded al-Sisi, who obviously was more supportive of sort of Sharia and fundamentalist Islam. So there is this hope that with the current president, who's sympathetic to the church and certainly would like reform in Islam, that he can bring about peace and protection for the country's Christians.
Right. Well, shifting gears, the Order of the Knights of Malta will be electing a new Grand Master. Briefly, what is the current situation there?
Well, the current situation is that the Grand Master, it's been vacant since January when Pope Francis asked Fra Matthew Festing to resign as Grand Master, which he did under obedience. Since then, that's been vacant. It's grown up through a dispute between the Grand Master and the Grand Chancellor, Albrecht von Bösselage, who was asked to resign and then reinstated by the Vatican a month later, back in January. So there's a lot of controversy about this. There's a lot of battles between different factions within the Order of Malta. It's not a particularly edifying spectacle, but it's something that I think has got to be worked out in the next during this election when they elect a new Grand Master. And I think there's a lot at stake here because there is one side which wants to reform the order, the ancient order, make it what they say more modern, and the others who want to keep it as it is, or at least have more moderate reforms and let it abide by its traditions. Mm-hmm. And they're sort of vying, there's a bit of a power struggle, certain groups vying for control of the order and others also doing the same. So it's quite a problematic situation, but one which I think many hope will be worked out during this election on Saturday.
Right. Well, and I know, Edward, you have been reporting on this story from the very beginning. So thank you for your work there. And I know all of our readers look forward to reading your next articles on the election and your accounts every day of the Pope's trip and the aftermath.
Thank you.
Well, when we come back, I'm joined by Jason Calvey of EWTN News Nightly, their Capitol Hill correspondent, about President Trump's first 100 days. What a wild ride it's been.
Bishop Robert Barron talks about the importance of the National Catholic Register.
You know, the Register delivers something which is extremely important because you won't get it from the mainstream media, namely the Catholic context and perspective. Sometimes the mainstream media will pretend, oh, they don't have a perspective. They're just giving the news neutrally. Well, no one does that. Everyone's got a perspective. What they often bring is a sort of secularist ideology. The National Catholic Register brings a robustly Catholic take on the world, and that's indispensably important.
For a free 6-issue trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy our online content.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Matthew Bunsen, senior editor for the National Catholic Register. My co-host, Jeanette DeMello, has the week off. Well, I'm joined now by Jason Calvey, EWTN News Nightly, Capitol Hill correspondent, and he's been covering the whirlwind first 100 days of a new Congress and a new administration. Jason, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I think this is the first time you've been on Register Radio.
It is.
It is. So welcome. I look forward to having you on repeatedly.
Please.
Well, this has been, to put it mildly, I think, an intense 100 days in D.C. for the new administration, but also for Congress, and I think for the whole D.C. establishment. As we all stop to take a breath, what's your sense among the elected officials here in the nation's capital of where we are exactly?
It's been an absolute whirlwind. The first 100 days have gone by so quickly. There was an Easter break last week, so they were able to take a little time off and enjoy with their families, but it's been nonstop up until that break, and then right now back this last week here that we've been back since the Easter break, it's just been nonstop, a flurry of activity, trying to get this health care bill passed, trying to deal with world crises like, for example, the situation in North Korea with the nuclear missiles as they progress in their capabilities to possibly take aim at the United States. At least that's the worry of senior military officials here in Washington. So it's just been nonstop. Every time you think you're going to have a break, and it something else happens.
When you talk to seasoned officials on the Hill, from elected senators to representatives to just staffers, have they ever seen anything quite like this first couple of months?
I don't think so. I mean, the president had promised to come in and be a disruptor in chief, and we've seen that in the 100 days, right? One tweet that he sends out will disrupt the whole narrative, and now we have to, the Republicans have to change their approach, thinking about health care, for example. It used to be that Republicans would talk about, we're going to repeal Obamacare. And then President-elect Trump said, well, how about we repeal and replace. And then, right. So Republicans had to scramble to figure out, well, what's the replacement plan going to look like?
And then they kept using the word repair.
Yes.
So the other thing that has been striking immediately in these first 100 days is there's this flurry of activity, but there also seems to be a level of acrimony that's almost shocking.
You and I covered the Gorsuch hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and here's a man with credentials that we couldn't even believe. I mean, how many PhDs and, you know, doctorates and has a record where – what was his record on the bench? I mean, how many of his cases have actually been overturned?
I think it was like seven.
Yeah.
Right.
So most of his cases have been affirmed by higher courts, and what a winning record. But look at what happened at that hearing where – the other side, the Democrats, were just blasting him and refusing to even support him. Only a handful of Democrats actually voted for his confirmation.
Yeah,
that's how partisan it's become.
In a different era, he probably would have been confirmed 97-0.
Right.
But this is a different era.
Right. And maybe one or two Democrats would have voted against him in a different era, but this time around it
was. So as a Capitol Hill correspondent, and I'm not being nice when I say you have to be one of the hardest working people in Washington because you are always on the run. I know you talked to everyone up on the Hill. How bad is that division? I mean, there's this perception in politics today that everyone hates everyone else, so just simply being on the other party. But does that actually trickle down to the way people interact on a daily basis?
It's interesting to watch the lawmakers when there's a world situation, like right now with North Korea or weeks ago with the Syria chemical attack. And when something like that happens, you do see some of the partisan divides healing, and you see people coming together and saying, what do we need to do for this world? What do we need to do for this country to bring healing? And so you see them maybe at least at that situation. There might be a few outliers who still want to condemn what the president's suggesting, but you do see with North Korea and also with the Syria situation, people coming together and saying, we need to act. We need to come together and let these divisions be done with, at least for this issue. Now we'll come back and debate internal politics next week or something
right.
like that.
So there are still areas where you can find at least some idea of striving for the common good.
Right. Yesterday, for example, the senators all went to the White House and were given a confidential briefing on the situation in North Korea. And they all loaded onto a bus. They loaded onto a bus, kind of like school kids, right? And they're sitting there. They're taking selfies with each other. So you can see them coming together at least fraternally on that bus ride over to the White House. Maybe that was one of the goals of why they had it at the White House and not at the Senate.
Good point. Okay, so from a Catholic standpoint, has Trump done a decent job in keeping his campaign promises?
President or campaign candidate Trump wrote two letters to Catholics, one to CatholicVote.org and another to Catholic leaders. And what he promised there was he was going to protect religious freedom. He promised and he also made promises separately to pro-life leaders as well. And he promised to, you know, defund Planned Parenthood, to nominate a pro-life Supreme Court justice, and that one is the big victory. I think all Republicans and all people that are supporting the president are pointing to the Judge Gorsuch, now Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch, as one of the big wins for Donald Trump, and especially regarding the pro-life cause. As you know, Judge Gorsuch on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals sided on behalf of the Little Sisters of the Poor mm-hmm. and also Hobby Lobby in their fight against the contraceptive mandate, forcing most employers to provide contraception, sterilization, and abortion-inducing drug services on their health plans.
Right. And then there's the promise to defund Planned Parenthood that seems to be making its way through. I mean, there were a number of victories in those first 100 days for that.
Right. For example, the repeal of Obamacare, repeal and replace of Obamacare, will also, part of that will defund Planned Parenthood for 1 year. And so that is definitely part of the legislation moving forward. I know Republicans have been struggling to come to consensus on some of the other particulars, but on that one, they've been united, except for some moderates who have maybe wanted to see the defunding of Planned Parenthood taken out of the bill. But Republicans, the Speaker Ryan, all the way to the Freedom Caucus, which is the hard right group in the Republican caucus, have been supporting that defunding of Planned Parenthood. So that looks like it's likely going to happen once they pass this bill to repeal Obamacare.
Right. Now, just a few days ago, members of Congress, both in the House and Senate, sent a request to the president to sign this executive order regarding religious liberty. Where does that stand?
So about 50, I think about 52 or 50, more than 50 representatives sent that letter to the president asking him to sign that executive order. Part of the executive order, which was leaked, there was a draft that was leaked, I think back in February. And what it said was it would, for example, take care of the HHS mandate. I think it would scrap the HHS contraceptive mandate. That was one part of it. It would also provide protections for your bakers and your photographers who right now in places across the country are being targeted with lawsuits. For example, if they don't want to – if because of their religious faith, they cannot shoot photos of a so-called gay wedding. They can't do that because that violates the deepest part of their beliefs about what is marriage between a man and a woman solely. And so you're seeing these lawsuits across the country targeting, you know, various artists, photographers, bakers. And part of this executive order may protect those artists, those artisans. One question, though, is this is a very divisive issue. So the president needs to figure out how to get it right. He's going to alienate some people that are more moderate, more on the left that will see this as somehow an attack. But as you know, this is not an attack on people that have different views. What it is protecting the religious views of the faithful.
When we had a glimpse into how intense people are about this issue right now, because just a few days ago we had the Justice Department requesting from the Fifth Circuit mm-hmm. Court of Appeals for an extra 60 days to get their business in order regarding exactly what the Supreme Court wanted them to do, was to settle these lawsuits. Where does that stand now? Because there seemed to be some confusion based on what the Washington Post was reporting and a few others were.
The Washington Post headline said that the Trump administration was not going or was going to defend the HHS contraceptive mandate. When I talked with the Justice Department, one of the things they said is that is not true. They're not – they have asked for 60 days to work through this issue with the parties. As you know, the Supreme Court asked the various plaintiffs who are fighting the HHS mandate and the government to work together to come to some compromise. And right now, the Trump administration and the Department of Justice in particular has asked for 60 days to sort of work through the issues. And when I asked the Justice Department, why didn't you just settle these out of court? You could have done that. They said, well, part of the lawsuit involves the labor secretary, you know, also involves the Health and Human Services Secretary and the Attorney General. So right. All three of those positions need to be filled, which at the point of this filing, the labor secretary was not in place yet.
Right.
So they need – and also some of the staff members and the undersecretaries in the various departments are also not filled. So they said they needed more time. It's a very complex issue and they want to get it right.
And I think one of the reasons that eyebrows were raised was the fact that you had the same Obama-era lawyers who were the ones who represented the government in this case before the court.
That's true.
So it gives us an idea of just how long it might take to replace some of these.
And their lawyers, I mean, their job is to represent their client, and they're working for the government, but they're looking for – these lawyers are going to need to get direction from their higher-ups as to how they want to handle these cases.
Now, very briefly, how is the working relationship between the administration and the leadership on the Hill? We were just talking about acrimony. You have the sense sometimes that not everyone's on the same page here.
True, but one of the things that's really interesting to watch with this administration is you see Vice President Pence at the Capitol almost every other couple days at the Capitol making his pitch, working with lawmakers, trying to come up with negotiations, including when they're dealing with trying to come up with a replacement plan for Obamacare. So you see there's a lot more presence on the Hill at the Capitol with the administration. For example, the Secretary of Health and Human Services was there today meeting with conservative lawmakers, including Representative Hartzler of Missouri and the Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, as well as Representative Chris Smith, who's the co-chair of the Pro-Life Caucus in the House. They're all meeting today to talk about conscience protections, especially as it regards not having to provide abortion coverage on health care plans.
Mm-hmm. So given that, in the short amount of time we have left, what are your predictions for the health care plan?
I think it looks very likely going to get a vote in the House soon. The House Freedom Caucus had been putting the brakes on. They wanted to they said it the original plan put forward by the Republican leadership was Obamacare light. It didn't do enough to replace or to repeal Obamacare. And so now this week, just yesterday, they came out and said they are going to support the new plan. They say it satisfies their requests for a conservative vision for health care. So that was the major stumbling block, was the Freedom Caucus had been putting the brakes on. Now you still have moderates who are looking for some other things, and right now I think it's just working one-on-one to get some of those moderates to sign on to backing this healthcare plan. So we'll see when it actually comes up for a vote in the House, and then when it goes over to the Senate, it will be completely changed because the Senate has a different way of working, and they'll be proposing a bunch of amendments to the House version in the Senate, and so it might be completely different once it passes through the Senate, and then it will go back to the House, and they'll come back and negotiate in the middle.
And that's when the fun really starts.
That's right.
and I know you're going to be there to cover it.
Yes. Yeah. Every night on EWTN News Nightly, Monday through Friday, 6 Eastern, and as well as 9 Eastern.
Well, this has been, as I said, a whirlwind. I hope you have a chance to catch your breath a little bit.
I'd like to have a Fitbit. Please don't send me a Fitbit, but I'd like to just figure out how many steps I take every day at the Capitol, because it's fun. We're running around all day long.
Well, Jason, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of EWTN's Register Radio. I'm grateful for Jason Calvey for his time and his work on the Hill. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Jeanette DeMello and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Until next week, God bless.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.